Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, science, and healthcare in the news, debate, dialogue, discussion, answers to your emails and your on-air questions, and, well, whatever else comes along. Before we go any further, what's coming along is the statement that the statements on this program represent, and opinions represent, the speakers and not necessarily this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I want to just give you a little bulletin about swine flu. Now, with all of the other things that are going on in the news, we have major issues that are of actual real life concern as opposed to just theoretical. And that's what's going to happen with the H1N1 flu. Now, a couple of things that came out this week that are important. This flu is showing up much earlier all over the country than the seasonal flu that we really don't expect to even start hitting until November, December. And this part of the country generally peaks in January. But the H1N1 is already starting to roll, and with the return of children to school, that being the big vector group, we are starting to see it. There are 40 schools in the San Jose Unified School District, the largest school district near us. Most have at least had one likely case. There haven't been severe cases of the flu, and at least in Santa Clara County, the death toll is at a grand total of 5 cases. But a new researcher published something at the CDC. This was presented Monday at the American Society for Microbiology, and it shows that the H1N1 flu actually has a different contagion cycle. So you may want to note this one down. Normally, we think of people as being infectious with the flu for a few days during the cough and sneezing phase, but H1N1 is more contagious because it has a longer period where people shed virus. And in fact, people are contagious for a couple of days while they're incubating this virus before they even begin to cough or sneeze. And that's one of the things that makes it so difficult to contain the spread of this. Once people begin having fever and sore throats and body aches, they are at their most contagious, and we would thank them very much to stay out of public places during those moments. When the fever breaks, traditionally we've sent children back to school, but in the case of H1N1, that may not necessarily be a great idea because Gaston Deserres, the scientist in question here, has established that you remain contagious still 7 days out from the beginning of the illness. So people with just a little residual cough are still contagious. Another good bit of news that came out is that a single 15 microgram dose of flu vaccine does appear to be protective. And this is a trial done in Australia. It looks like one shot will be enough. And that's good because there are production delays and we are not looking at seeing our first vaccine coming out and getting widely distributed. They're saying now first week of October for the very first bits of vaccine, but probably mid-October before it's been widely distributed. People being targeted early, healthcare and emergency workers, pregnant women, because pregnant women are more likely to get very sick, everyone from 6 months to 24 years, and any adult up to the age of 64 with medical problems, such as asthma or heart disease or immune disorders, and people caring for infants under 6 months old, because guess what? We really don't have a vaccine that we're happy giving to infants under 6 months old, but fortunately, they tend to stay indoors and their movements can be controlled. So if we can just get their caregivers vaccinated, we stand a good chance of protecting them. Now, on the subject of the flu vaccine, we've covered it, but on the subject of the antiviral medications, and this is something really pretty important, everyone is saying, and CDC and researchers are saying, don't take Tamiflu or Relenza for preventative cases. There's a risk-benefit ratio that does not favor that use. Tamiflu and Relenza are to be used in people who are very sick. And again, the same group, pregnant women, children younger than five, people with heart disease and asthma. When these people get the flu, it's being suggested to doctors that they treat empirically. That means without waiting for confirmatory testing. And the triad that you're looking for is a sudden onset of fever and body aches, along with typical cold symptoms. So if people are calling me with a bad sore throat and a cough, and they have no body aches and no fever, I am saying, you don't have the flu. And I'm doing that without a test, because this flu causes pretty significant fever and pretty significant body aches. So I think it's important that we all keep that in mind. We had an off-air question regarding last week's detoxification show. How does milk thistle and other supplements help with detoxification? Well, in the case of silymarin, which is the active component in milk thistle, it has several functions, but it upregulates the cytochrome P450s and it upregulates the phase two detoxification. So the thing that last week's show was trying to really emphasize is that we break down drugs in two stages. In the phase one stage, substances actually become more dangerous and more reactive briefly. And then in the phase two stage, they are quenched. It's kind of like heating up a piece of metal and then dropping it into a bucket of water. That quenching involves the glucuronidation, the sulfonation, and the other pathways, the glycination. And that's where the diet high in fruits and vegetables, particularly the cruciferous or sulfur-containing compounds, has such advantages to helping prevent cancer and other diseases associated with environmental toxins, even natural environmental toxins found in food, and our endogenous environmental toxins, which is to say the breakdown products of our own hormones. All of these things are dangerous until they are encased, so to speak, in their water-soluble form that can be removed from the body and contained in a bladder or contained in a bowel until such time as it's evacuated. So I hope that's helpful. The exact biochemistry is really beyond the scope of this program, but if you do a Google Scholar search on milk thistle or silymarin, you'll come across the exact biochemical mechanisms. Let's go to email. The first one I'm going to do is David in Pacific Grove, and David's a regular listener. He has an elevated HDL. Let me just read this section of his rather long email. My question, which you might address on the show, is that my MD, along with my blood results, sent along the suggestion that since my HDL, that's the high-density lipoprotein, folks, that's the good, healthy cholesterol, has always been, due to genetic propensity, low, that I might want to take 500 milligrams of a B vitamin. I forget for sure, but it may have been thiamine. Actually, David, it would have been niacin that your doctor was suggesting that you take as a means of elevating HDL if I can withstand the flushing it produces. So first, what is the mechanism of this process? High doses of niacin alter the production of the lipoproteins by the liver, so you get a decrease in triglycerides, and the triglycerides alter the amount of HDL. There's an inverse relationship, like a teeter-totter. So the higher your triglycerides, the lower your HDL. And if you're starting out with a very low HDL, like David is because of his genetics, that can be all by itself a risk factor for heart disease. Is it really effective? Yes. The doses for niacin may go up to 2 or 3,000 milligrams. 500 milligrams is a very low dose. I typically have people buy 100 milligram niacin and work themselves up very, very slowly over several months to the high doses, because if you do it very slowly, the body adapts to the flushing fairly well. But if you just jump right in with a high dose, you get the equivalent of a hot flash, sometimes also with uncomfortable GI effects, and it's very difficult for people to tolerate. What other means can I use to elevate HDL, asks David, and the answer there is exercise. Particularly weightlifting and resistance exercise elevates HDL, and this presumably is because as you do weightlifting, building muscle. And HDL can be thought of as the construction crew taking the construction materials out to the building site. So the cholesterol that is made by the body, instead of being stored, which is what the lumpy, low-density lipoprotein is, that's the storage form. Instead of being stored, it's actually being used to build new cell walls. So if you think of it that building muscle actually uses up cholesterol, that's a really direct way of thinking about exercise and HDL. How critical is the HDL issue for me, given my most recent blood data? This is a very classic example. David tells us he has a total cholesterol of 171 and a triglyceride of 131 and an HDL of 29. And 29 is low. If you take the total cholesterol and divide by his HDL, you get a ratio of 5.9. And any ratio above 5 is associated with an increased risk of heart disease from the population baseline. David also has some diabetes issues, but his hemoglobin A1C is in good control at 5.8. So he's done very well with his weight loss as far as controlling his pre-diabetes, but he still has an issue as far as the HDL is concerned. And my best advice for you, David, is try the niacin very slowly, as I've outlined. Sometimes a baby aspirin can help with the flushing, but of course that carries its own risks for GI bleeding. The weightlifting, if you aren't already doing that and you don't have an elevated blood pressure, which I don't, to my recollection, think you do, that would be a good way for you to proceed. Another email, this one, a rather sad story from Mary in Windsor. Mary writes, "Several weeks ago, my ex-husband, the father of our four children, was on life support in Portland after what was believed to be an accidental overdose of Valium. Several questions in hindsight still haunt me. Since we were divorced, the children had the responsibility of making end-of-life medical decisions. He died about 15 hours after entering the emergency room after being found unresponsive in bed at his home, not under the immediate care of a physician for any life-threatening event. I was told initially he would require an autopsy. However, my children were despondent when the charge nurse brought it out, and somehow it was dismissed as unnecessary. Yet when I talked with the ER doctor with my children present, he explained that their dad had not died of a narcotic overdose, but of a Valium overdose. So my questions are these. How toxic is Valium, and how much would cause an overdose? Is it possible he had some kind of sleep apnea, as the kids believe, that should have been tested? He did not have a do not resuscitate order, but the EMTs and the doctors think that he had been without breathing for some time due to the immediate extensive brain swelling. And they gave him drugs and defib to make his heart pump, but he never breathed again. How is that ethical? Finally, I think the law should be followed and an autopsy should have been performed, but I had no legal rights and I chose not to press the kids. Maybe your answers could clarify for myself and others the functions and limits of end-of-life care and physicians' responsibilities." Well, Mary, thank you very much. And with all the talk of death committees and such, I think it's maybe a good idea to revisit the basic concepts here that we use. First of all, when a person is found down and unresponsive, in the absence of any written piece of paper pinned to their chest, to the contrary, there's an absolute necessity. We must resuscitate. Only a physician can declare someone dead. Resuscitation will begin even if the body is cold, because we know hypothermia patients sometimes can be revived and do surprisingly well. Valium depresses the respiratory centers, and if a person has sleep apnea, they are much more vulnerable to this effect. So the possibility of sleep apnea that you raise is a very important one. I think it's quite likely that a person with severe sleep apnea could inadvertently die from only a mild overdose of Valium. In general, Valium is given at doses of 5 or 10 milligrams. I have seen serious overdoses at doses as low as 100 milligrams, that is to say 10 times that amount, where people have stopped breathing. How rapidly the body breaks down the Valium is a key factor, that liver detoxification stuff we talked about last week being critical here. So there's a wide range of variability. If the drugs are mixed with a narcotic or another respiratory depressant like alcohol, then the effect is much greater and the toxic dose is much lower. I say this because I think it's important to understand that the intention of your ex-husband, whether he was committing suicide or whether he had an accident, cannot be ascertained either by examining the number of pills in his stomach or by an autopsy. Intention can never be determined by autopsy. In this case, the fact that he had all that brain swelling could not be ascertained until after he'd had a head scan. He might have been a stroke patient. He might have had any number of things when he was found. And so the initial decision to resuscitate and begin life support was completely appropriate, in my opinion. Drugs like Valium and hydrocodone inhibit pupil responses and reflexes. So it's only after these drugs wear off that brain death can actually be ascertained. When a person has a chance to wear off, when the drugs have been reversed, and we do have chemical reverses for both of these, and spontaneous respiration does not recur, then you have essentially a situation where a person who is clinically dead is being breathed for by a machine. And at that point, it is an act of great gentleness and compassion to allow the family to decide to stop the breathing machine. In fact, we have as a society no obligation to keep a dead person breathing. The fact that we do so at all is to allow the family to come to a state of acceptance and understanding and give them some sort of sense of empowerment in the decision to withdraw life support. But the person is already dead at that point. If they have no spontaneous respirations, they're just a beating heart and a ventilator. So I don't really think that anything wrong was done there. As you tell the story with your doubts, the ambiguities that you describe are just innate to the situation. But I would assure you that this could have been an accident and probably was an accident. And I hope that that will help you and your children as you go forward with your lives. Let's go to our next caller, and that's Billy in Santa Cruz. Hello, Billy. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm quite well. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. What can I do for you?
Well, I'm 63, and I have osteoarthritis in my wrist. This has been developing for a number of years now. It's gotten quite severe. I have tried a couple different times of 6 or 8 months each, taking glucosamine with MSM. Didn't seem to have any effect. And I'm wondering about, I've heard about injectable synthetic cartilage that can be done, in, at least with knee osteoarthritis in the knees.
Are you referring to Synovisc?
Yes, that's it.
It's actually not cartilage. It's a lubricant, like WD-40 for your knee. It's hyaluronic acid. But it does actually act to make the cartilage not be as irritated. And it has an anti-inflammatory effect in many people. It can help with their osteoarthritis. So it's
what I have is in my wrist, and I have not been able to find on the internet so far references to it being used for osteoarthritis
in the wrist. Well, it's technically very difficult to get a needle into the right place in a wrist.
And that's what I was wondering.
Yeah, the knee is a big space, big old joint, big old space. And one joint, well, two if you count the kneecap part, but realistically, it's easy to get a needle and inject material into the knee space. The wrist is actually 7 bones, and technically speaking, each of those bones has at least 2 articular and sometimes 3 articular surfaces. So the wrist is really kind of 21 different surfaces, and they're all pretty close together, so there's not much space to get the needle into. Even if you get the needle in there, the gel that you're injecting isn't necessarily going to migrate down to between the cartilage layers. So I'm unaware of any use of this therapeutically in the wrist. People may be trying it in joints like finger joints and maybe shoulders, which are single space joints, but I don't know if it would even work in the wrist. You know, getting the stuff where it needs to be, which is between the surfaces, is really tricky in a wrist situation.
The same thing applied to taking out a little bit of cartilage and growing new cartilage in a laboratory and then reinserting it. I've heard of that being done as well.
Again, easier in a big joint
where
you can get in there and put it in the right place. Wrists are tricky. The growing cartilage and transplanting it is definitely still in the experimental stage. It's not an established therapy, and I think everyone is working very hard because as we start living longer, being able to restore the articular surfaces as they wear out, kind of like retreading the tires, is really a critical aspect to improving quality of life in the second 50 years.
Would orally taken hyaluronic acid be useful?
I'm not aware of any studies. I think it probably mostly breaks down. I'm not aware of any positive studies. Things like glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate in some people seem to be very helpful. And these are precursors that the body uses to make hyaluronic acid. And so I think in some people you can drive it forward. I also want to point out that really there's two concepts here when you talk about osteoarthritis. There's the wear and tear that you can see on an x-ray, and there's pain and inflammation. And many people have very ugly looking joints and no pain because those joints are not inflamed.
And vice versa.
And vice versa. So going after the inflammation is where your best strategy is. And so that would include an anti-inflammatory diet. You can just search that online. But oddly enough, the anti-inflammatory diet is pretty much the same diet that we advise for hypertension. Lots of fruits and vegetables. The difference being we throw in some curcumin, some turmeric, some garlic, and a couple of other plant-based anti-inflammatories, and lots of fish oil. So omega-3 fatty acids and curcumin and the quercetins of the world, these are all anti-inflammatory compounds. Fruits and vegetables contain a host of compounds which are anti-inflammatory in nature. So modifying your diet, and I might add removing the things that are pro-inflammatory, which is basically anything that causes your insulin to increase. So concentrated sugars, concentrated starches, pasta, cola drinks, these things are actually going to increase inflammation measurably in your body through an indirect mechanism related to insulin. So you want to get rid of those, add in the other things, and see if you can modify the threshold of your body to have inflammation. Those are also really important steps you can take.
You mentioned fish oil. I'm vegan, and I'm wondering, what about DHA supplements? Because I believe those are long-chain omega-3 fatty acids. Am I correct?
DHA is a long-chain omega-3 fatty acid, exactly, and that's what I'm talking about. That's anti-inflammatory.
Okay, good.
All right. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And we're going now to Beulah. Hello, Beulah, and welcome to the show.
Thank you. I was listening to the email, the call just before the last call.
Yes.
And I remember being told that if you did not want to be resuscitated, and I have known people, you know, very old and in bad shape who didn't want to go through all that, that you should put a sign on the refrigerator and that responders look there to see before they do start CPR.
That's absolutely true, but
do you have to sign it? Does a doctor have to?
Yeah, there's a special document that you need to have. This is a legal matter. Suppose your evil nephew wanted to inherit the house. I mean, he could sneak in before he smothered you and put the sign on the refrigerator. I mean, This is the sort of thing they discuss at the legislature, believe it or not. But the idea is the first responders are taught that if they see that document, the legal document, they're off the hook. They can't be held liable. They won't be talking to the district attorney. They won't lose their job. A handwritten sign, first of all, it would be a horrible thing to do to the poor first responder because then they're really torn. Do I take a risk with my livelihood, et cetera, or do I disobey the clearly articulated wishes of the person here? So that's kind of mean. Get the official document. The Hemlock Society has it. The Hemlock Society?
Oh, the Hemlock Society.
Yeah. They have it. Hospice has copies.
I think the Red Cross had something.
They may very well have that. Mm. I do think that we all need to understand that as we get older, our chances of being successfully resuscitated are very poor.
Yes.
And the consequences of a partially successful resuscitation are things like disability and brain damage. There is a point, perhaps, where one is independent and satisfied to go, where filling out one of these documents, even if you don't have a quote-unquote life-threatening disease, you've just got old age, and have a poor probability of quality survival if you try to die and are foiled in the process by a resuscitation attempt.
And this you do put on the refrigerator?
That's right. And they do look on the refrigerator. You're right.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Sarah. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
What can I do for you?
Well, I would just like you to discuss bipolar in general because I was diagnosed with that about 2 years ago. I'm 67 now.
Mm-hmm.
And my symptoms were basically what I thought was seasonal affective disorder. like when the wintertime comes and Christmas comes, I get so depressed, like so many of my friends, of people, so many of us. And then summer comes and I'm okay. But this year, summer's come and I am okay, but now now I'm so high, I'm just way out there. Like I tell my sisters, I have to curb my enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm. You
know, crazy things.
Well, okay, it's possible, I guess, to be bipolar. I mean, I'm not a psychiatrist, but and have such a long cycle of swings that it takes the full year for you to go from up to down. More classic bipolar disorder, the oscillations are much more rapid, but it is possible. And one of the things that immediately comes to mind is sun exposure and its effects in your brain in terms of both melatonin release and also vitamin D being produced in your skin more in the summer and less in the winter. So one of the things I would strongly recommend for you is to measure vitamin D levels maybe 4 times a year and measure it when you're up, when you're really hyper too, and see what the vitamin D level is then. And you may want to...
How many levels to get? How high can you get with that? How many can you take a day?
Your body makes vitamin D, so when you're out in the sun, you make vitamin D, and your levels could go from, say, 20 in the winter to 70 in the summer. And if there's a consistent correlation between a vitamin D level of 70 in a person and them being hyper, then you might tell them to wear more sunscreen, and in the winter, supplement them up to, say, 50, and in the summer, kind of try to keep back them down a little bit. But it may not be vitamin D. It could just be the pineal gland, which secretes melatonin and is very responsive to the length of the day. And so some people are going to have a real, almost a hibernation cycle going on when the days get shorter. We call this seasonal affective disorder. And light therapy, which doesn't increase your vitamin D but does increase your melatonin, has been shown to be effective for that. So it's multiple factors here. But I'm just trying to suggest some things that might help you modulate this a little bit that are not pharmaceutical-based, because I'm sure you're very familiar with the drugs that are available for bipolar disorder.
Well, bringing you down from that terrible high, and Lamictal for bringing you up from that terrible low.
Well, that's one recipe, yeah. There's dozens of different recipes, but you got the idea.
Yeah, and that's the only one I've tried. I've almost gotten myself to a psychiatrist this week, but then I say, am I really going to take the medication if they prescribe it?
Well, what do you think? Are you?
Well, would you if you were me?
I think I would use medication if I felt that my quality of life was so impaired by my psychiatric condition that I was not living fully. And I would look for a medication combination that blunted that and blunted those swings or blunted that, whatever it was that was interfering with my quality of life, and got me back to being feeling healthy, happy, fulfilled, able to function in society, fulfill my roles, and also have some modicum of joy on a daily basis. If I needed chemical help to get there, then yeah, I would use it, but I would try to use the smallest dose, and I would be open to trying new things nutritionally or behaviorally to try to support that as much as possible.
Nutritionally, tell me a little bit. I do that flaxseed oil, that seems to help immensely. And I've also been taking, but we'll address that, and then I'm going to talk about vitamin D again.
Okay. Oh, well, flaxseed oil it's anti-inflammatory. It affects you in many different ways. First of all, it's an omega-3 fatty acid, but only about 10% of it ever turns into DHA, which is the one that's active in the brain, maybe 5%, depends on your physiology. So you have to take a lot of flaxseed oil to get the same sort of production that you would get with fish oil. But for someone who's a vegetarian, it's like, okay, lots and lots and lots of flax. It does also have effect on prostaglandins and leukotrienes, and those are inflammatory chemicals that are present in the brain as well as in the peripheral body tissue, and they have an influence on how your brain works as well. And then you had another question about vitamin D.
So I do get quite a bit of sun, and I've also been taking lots of vitamin D, up, say, 1,000 a day. Mm-hmm. I don't do that. My brother does that. He's the one that...
Yeah. Maybe what needs to happen is that the high-dose vitamin D needs to be measured against levels, And then in the winter is when you're doing the high-dose vitamin D. In the summer, it may be too much, particularly if you're a person who gets hyper in the summer.
Yeah.
So you may need to back it down part of the year.
Yeah, I've been doing it. I better back down because I'm way out there.
Well, okay. Get a level.
Sarah,
get a level now, though, okay? Find out what blood level correlates with being really out there, okay?
Oh, thanks. That's a great idea.
All right. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I want to take a moment before we go to our next caller and tie in with that earlier email. This is a study about sleep apnea. Let's see, this came out of Australia. I'm getting it off of a journal called Family Practice News. Two studies done in Australia looking at all-cause mortality and severe sleep apnea. Basically, what they found is that if you have mild sleep apnea, there's really no difference between mild sleep apnea and no sleep apnea in terms of its effect on your probability of dying. And this was a 14-year study. The hazard risk ratio, in other words, the multiplier for risk of death in this 14-year-old study, was quite significant, sixfold. So the study looked at 380 participants for an average of 13 years. The mortality rate was 30% higher among the patients with moderate to severe sleep apnea. This is a big increase. And the study controlled for things like age, body mass index, blood pressure, smoking, cholesterol, and other factors that would be considered to maybe bias it. So it's not, well, you're fat, that gives you risk factors and you get sleep apnea along with that. They controlled for that. So pure sleep apnea alone does increase the risk of death by about 30%. Important information. And of course, if you happen to be taking Valium or sleeping pills, you may end up like the unfortunate gentleman whose case we discussed earlier. Let's go to Gary in Felton. Hello, Gary, and welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm 62, and I can get to sleep without any difficulty whatsoever, but after 2 or 3 hours, I'm basically awake. And if I felt good and rested, I don't think that would be a problem, but I don't feel good and rested. And I've been through every conventional and integrative medicine test and protocol. And the only thing that seems to help, I mean, aside from Ambien, which I don't want to take, but a friend of mine suggested to me, get some protein an hour before bed. So I've been having a little bit of, like, smoked salmon. And on occasion, that really does seem to help. I don't know if it's placebo or what. But I know my cortisol level is high. I know stress management is part of my work, so I don't think that's a problem. But nobody seems to have any advice except go to Stanford's very expensive sleep clinic and find out what's going on. And before I do that, I don't even know if that would help me.
Well, of course, you can't know whether something's going to help until you try it. But let's kind of go back a little bit, because when someone says, oh, I've tried everything, I'm like, no, you haven't. You've tried everything you know about.
And try me.
I have other questions for you. We're not going to run the list, but I want to know, what time do you go to bed?
Generally go to bed around 11.
What time do you get up?
11:30. Well, what time, like to get up?
Yes, what time do you need to be up in the morning?
Well, when I can sleep, we're up at, I would say 7:30, but I'm waking up at, 2:30, 3 o'clock.
Okay. Now let me stop you and ask you alcohol consumption. Have you gone without alcohol for a month?
Without alcohol for a month?
Yeah.
No, I have not.
All right. There's something you haven't heard of, but
right.
I'll tell you that when I have someone who's got intractable insomnia, the first thing I have them do is stop the booze for a month. And if they can't, then we have another issue. You know, that's a great way to smoke out the difference between being a habit drinker and having an alcohol problem. But
right.
If you stop drinking for a month, there are certain things that reestablish themselves in your brain, and one of them may be a normal sleep cycle. So that's number one.
Right.
The other thing is there are a lot of hidden stimulants in foods. There's a lot of caffeine and chocolate. So I also have people stop using stimulants because some people don't break down the stimulants in their diet. And so if you remove all caffeine, that means no chocolate, no coffee, no tea, no soda. You do that along with the alcohol, a lot of sleep problems go away. And the waking up at 2 to 3 in the morning, you know, between 3 and 5 is classic. There's an energy cycle, then we're jumping into acupuncture now, but there's an energy cycle that happens where people transfer their chi from organ system to organ system. And when you jump from the liver to the lung, which is somewhere around 3 in the morning is when that energy transfer takes place. A lot of people wake up if they've got too much chi and too much liver chi, and that could be anger, and that could be booze, and that could be caffeine or other detoxification issues. It makes sense both in terms of just historically what's worked for my patients in my practice, plus there's also there's an explanation that's at least plausible within a structural framework called traditional Chinese medicine. So that to me means you give it a try. The other things, do you have to get up and pee? Is this a prostate issue?
I do have a prostate issue, but in the past, that hasn't prevented me from getting back to sleep.
Yes, but it may be doing so now in combination with these other factors. So having to wake up to pee, you know, could be a factor. So things that soothe the prostate, like saw palmetto, or maybe even one of the drugs that we use on a trial basis, just to see if we can get you sleeping through the night, would be a strategy. And I'm very intrigued by your comment about the protein. And I'm wondering whether that's the tryptophan. Now, people can take as a pill L-tryptophan or 5-hydroxytryptophan is now what's available most widely. Some people find that's extremely helpful for sleeping. I'm wondering if you are getting the benefit from the tryptophan in the protein that you're eating. Just curious about that as a possibility. The other thing is there's an old strategy of using the combination of melatonin as a extended release and tryptophan. This is old natural medicine lore, but the concept is the 5-HTP to fall asleep and the melatonin to stay asleep. And paradoxically, you want the lower dose of melatonin, like a 1 milligram dose, rather than the 3 to 5 dose that's more commonly what people buy as supplements. So there's all sorts of biphasic things going on with sleep cycles. A couple more things to throw out there are you don't get to sleep late on the weekends. You have to establish a solid out-of-bed time and a solid in-bed time in order to make use of the behavioral trainable rat in the brain, so to speak. We all contain a trained rat in our brain, and sometimes the rat has been trained, for example, to associate pleasure with little white pieces of paper wrapped around tobacco. And once that training is established, it's difficult to untrain the rat, but rat training techniques do work. So change of scenery, change of venue, new colors, new smells, things like that will help retrain the rat in your head. In the case of sleep, you're trying to entrain a behavior. So you do the standard sleep hygiene stuff, regular bedtime, regular wake up time. Bed is for sleeping and sex, not for TV or reading. You've read all of these things. I don't need to exhaustively go over them with you. And I think from what we've said here, I've given you some ideas. Am I right?
Yes, you have. One question, further question. I've been taking D3. Evidently, I had a D deficiency, D3 and B complex. But in addition to that, I have a naturopath friend who has me on a neurotransmitter supplement called NeuroReplete. And I don't know if you're familiar with it, but basically it's a 5-HTP supplement along with tyrosine and cysteine and so forth. Should that make any difference? Would you know?
Well, I'm not quite sure I understand your question. These are neurotransmitter precursors, so right. They can potentially increase the amount of neurotransmitter if you can push the reaction forward. It doesn't always work. Some people are making as much neurotransmitter as they physiologically can, and giving them more raw material doesn't increase the levels. So right. It's not a drug-like effect. It's sort of a precursor effect.
Right.
Raw material, in other words. How much wood can I fit in the oven? If I'm using a wood-burning stove that holds 2 logs, the house is not warmer if I have 8 logs stacked up by the side of the stove.
Right,
okay.
Got it.
So that's a try-it-and-see kind of question. There's also glycine, which is another amino acid. Glycine is a precursor for GABA, which is the neurotransmitter that's associated with relaxation. We were talking about a Valium overdose earlier in the show. Valium mimics GABA in the neurotransmitters. It's a ligand for the GABA receptor. So you can maybe give yourself a natural Valium effect by taking magnesium and glycine together. And I've certainly seen that used as well. Everybody has their magic recipe for potato salad, and everybody has their magic recipe for herbs for sleep. And most of them make a pretty good potato salad. And whether it's your favorite or not, well, that's where you have to play around and experiment. And generally, a week on any herb combination will tell you. If you're doing neurotransmitter precursors, I'd say 2 weeks. But if after 2 weeks on precursor agents like high-dose amino acids, you're not feeling any differently, then you probably got the 8 logs stacked up by the side of the wood-burning stove situation.
Got it. And that was, you just answered my question.
Good. Well, thank you very much for your call.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it. And you have given me some things that I haven't tried, so I appreciate it.
All right. Great. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I want to go now to Mary in Carmel.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was diagnosed 2.5 years ago with cutaneous vasculitis that manifests itself on the bottom of my feet. I have been taking prednisone since the diagnosis. I am now down to 6 milligrams with a small amount of Plaquenil and a small amount of colchicine. So I am in remission. I'm doing fantastically well since I discovered I am gluten sensitive.
Uh-huh.
And within 8 months, I have gone from inflammation to nothing. It's a miracle. Now, my question is, I still am taking the colchicine. I'm concerned about the flu shots. And should I take the regular flu shot and wait a month to take the swine flu? Or I just don't know what to do. I hate to load myself up
with flu vaccines. Okay. Well, let's start with prednisone and immune suppressants in general.
Yes.
There is not any clinical data that shows that being on low doses of prednisone, Plaquenil, other autoimmune modulators actually affects the take on the flu shot.
Okay.
So, nor is there any reason to be concerned that you will be immunosuppressed and get the flu from the flu shot.
All right.
So, let's kind of throw those two out there. In fact, people who are immunosuppressed are encouraged to get the flu shot. So, there is a reason for you to do that. Theoretically, and this is theoretical, and given the practical stuff, just in terms of trying to vaccinate huge quantities of the population with a new vaccine, that's going to be a bear strategically. So from a practical standpoint, you take the flu shot when you can get the flu shot. But for fine-tuning, I'm advising my patients to try to space the two vaccines at least 3 or 4 weeks apart if they can. Strategically.
Okay.
Because when you hit the system, we know this from research, when you hit the system with two viruses at once, they step on each other in terms of the amount of immune response that you can obtain.
Okay.
So it would make more sense to expose yourself to one viral coat protein, the current flu shot, which is now available and is already being distributed.
Yes.
That would be a good thing to get soon. You will not have access for at least 3 weeks. Absolute best case scenario to H1N1. It just won't be there for 3 weeks. So if you were to get a flu shot Monday, by the time the H1N1 was available to you, you would have gotten your immune response. And what we may end up doing, because we're vaccinating earlier this year, is we may revaccinate high-risk people in January if we're getting a late regular seasonal flu. If it behaves the way it usually does, I may revaccinate people and give them a booster.
Am I considered high-risk?
Because of the immunosuppressants, because of the Plaquenil and the prednisone, that gives you a relative high risk.
Okay.
And the reason you're high risk is you're high risk for post-flu pneumonia.
Right.
So in other words, you get the flu, it infects your lungs, it interferes with the immunity in your lungs. You've already got some immune issues because of the drugs you're taking. Along comes Staph aureus or some other bacteria. It moves into these lungs, which are now prostrate in terms of their ability to fight off a bacteria that ordinarily they would bounce right out. And so you get a necrotizing pneumonia, which is the nastiest thing in the world and very likely to kill you.
Would it be also prudent to get another pneumonia shot?
No. Okay. It's not that kind of pneumonia. This is actually Staph aureus, normally thought of as a skin infection.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And it's only after influenza that you're likely to get Staph aureus in your lungs.
Okay.
Influenza sets your lungs up for a kind of bacterial infection you ordinarily never see, and it's nasty. And that, and, you know, massive asthma overload from people who are vulnerable in that way, or just heart attack because the people have compromised system, and when they get the high fever and they're coughing and their mm-hmm. heart's beating and they just don't have the juice, the reserve in the heart. And mm-hmm. so they end up with a heart attack. So those are the ways that the flu kills you, the normal seasonal flu. It takes out the, you know, the weak ones in the herd who already have a vulnerability.
Okay.
But this H1N1, different story. Right now, it's not a very virulent or severe flu, and we're just keeping our fingers crossed that it's a mild, highly contagious flu. Everybody gets some immunity in the first 2 years. Then if it mutates into something nastier, most people will be immune to that.
Okay.
That's the best case scenario that we can hope for.
And I see.
So far, that's how it's playing out, so
okay.
I'm pretty happy.
Well, I hope you're right.
Me too.
That's very helpful.
Okay, good.
Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for calling.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye. All right, we have time for Marnie in Scotts Valley. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I am just calling because I have some pains in my legs, and so far I've had pretty much every test possible, and they can't figure out what's wrong with me. I'm currently in a wheelchair, and I can't walk because it's so painful.
Oh, my God.
And it's pretty much painful 24 hours a day. I haven't even gotten a pain medicine that can get rid of it yet, so I just thought I'd call and see what you had to say about it.
Well, kind of a tall order, Marnie, but let me start by kind of walking through how I would approach this, okay? I don't think I'm going to pull any rabbits out of the hat. I do appreciate your confidence, but let's start with, how old are you?
I am 46.
Do you have any health problems in terms of diabetes, high blood pressure, anything you take pharmaceutical medications for?
No, just I have migraines. That's the only thing I really take.
Okay, that's important. And so you take drugs for migraines?
Yes.
You take maybe the triptans when you get a migraine, or do you take some kind of preventative?
I am now, just recently, they put me on preventative Topamax, but I was taking Maxalt.
All right. This is important at several levels. The reason it's important is that people with migraines are generally, that's a sign of a problem with mitochondria, a problem with the way that your mitochondria produce energy. Possibly there can be just a congenital problem with the cytochrome system within the mitochondria, which is different than the cytochrome system in the liver that we talked about last week. But anyway, this can set people up for migraines, and it can also set them up for vascular spasms, strokes, and neuropathies. Now, the next question is, how did this pain begin? Did it begin in a sort of stocking, like you're wearing thigh-high nylons and that's the part of the leg that hurts? Or does it follow a more dermatomal distribution, kind of like a zebra stripe would be? Or did it start at the toes and work its way up? So that kind of manifestation of the pain is my next question. How did this start?
Okay, it started pretty suddenly, February 1st. It started in the bottom of my legs, and it was a sharp pain when I would walk.
Bottom of your legs, you mean the bottom of your feet?
Like right down by my ankles.
Your ankles. Did it go around your ankles like a donut?
It would shoot up my legs, up the side of my legs. And it was first like on one leg. Then after a few days, it was the right leg. And it was like the opposite on the outside of the leg, like where the nerve would go, and then it would shoot across the top of my foot. And then it was in both legs after about a week, and it stayed there, and I had to use crutches. And it would be shooting pains, and the bottom of my legs are like hypersensitive. If you touch them, they tingle.
All right. So now my next question for you is the imaging studies that have been done of your spinal column and your brain.
Yes, they've all been done. My spine looks fabulous, they say. They did an MRI of my brain. It looks good because they checked me for MS.
Right, because this could be a presentation of multiple sclerosis. Have you had nerve conduction studies of the long tract nerves in your lower extremities? This would be something a neurologist does.
Yes.
And those findings showed...
And those looked great.
Okay, so looked great means that the nerve conduction was all normal.
Right.
Okay. The next question I have for you is, and this is a homework thing, if you've got a check register, if you've got a diary, depends on, you know, what resources you have available for this. But it's time to go back to the couple of months before February 1st and think in terms of any new or novel exposures. And it could be something like methyl bromide because they fumigated the strawberry field across from my job. It could be that you spent time in a environment that might have had mold in it, but it's time to look for some sort of toxic insult, because you've had an anatomical reason ruled out. And the other thing is the drugs. So thinking back in terms of what was my drug regimen for my migraines, how many of the triptans had I taken? Did I have a particularly bad month in November and I used, you know, double the amount I normally do of whichever one you're using? Those are the sorts of questions to ask yourself. Is it unusual exposures? Because you have a sudden onset event that is non-structural. So it has to be physiological, and you have a physiological wild card in the sense that you've got the migraines, you've got a vulnerability there. So if I were going to chase this, I would chase it there. We're really out of time. If you're local and you want to contact my office, you can go to the Ask Dr. Don website and do so, and we'll try to get you in and do some of that testing. But I think you've had a very good workup so far, but there are things that haven't been thought of. Maybe I can help.
Okay.
All right. Good luck.
Thank you for your help.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Ask Dr. Don, and I just want to say so long and stay healthy.